Case versus Walker, Mr. McKinley.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm James McKinley with the Federal Defender's Office in Indianapolis. As you know, my client, Mr. Walker, entered a plea of guilty to assaulting four corrections officers at the United States Penitentiary of Terre Haute. He announced his decision to plead guilty in open court abruptly following a hearing in which Judge McKinney denied a request that the case be transferred from Terre Haute to Indianapolis based on Mr. Walker's belief that he could not receive a fair trial in Terre Haute. The court ordered a brief recess, during which Mr. Walker executed a petition to withdraw his plea of not guilty to enter a plea of guilty. The court reconvened and conducted the Rule 11 colloquy, during which I would point out that there was no specific admission on the part of Mr. Walker that this was a knowing and voluntary plea. On the contrary, in response to Judge McKinney's inquiry as to whether he was entering his plea intentionally, knowingly, voluntarily, he responded, "I'm pleading guilty because I can't get a fair trial." And Judge McKinney then turned to him and said, "I can't accept your plea if that's going to be your response. A voluntary plea requires that you plead guilty of your own free will," to which he responded, "Yeah, man, I'm pleading guilty." That is it. There's not much for me to add to what's contained in the record here concerning what transpired. Mr. Walker sent a letter to the court a couple of days later advising he wanted to withdraw his plea. He has continually maintained that the plea was involuntary. He's maintained that position. Suffice to say that he continues to this day to maintain that the plea was not voluntary. It was a product of the distress that he felt because he could not get a fair trial in Terre Haute, Indiana. And he maintains that the record here is insufficient to conclude anything else. Mr. Walker, as you know, was also sentenced to 240 months imprisonment, which was 30 months more than the maximum called for under the applicable advisory guideline range. We have raised the issue of lack of notice of the intent to impose an upward out-of-range guideline sentence here. The government has argued in response that we forfeited the issue by not objecting, and my research reflects that that does appear to be the rule in this court. Thus, the issue is subject to plain error review. I would maintain, however, that there was plain error here.
It's not true. Is it that you have to admit guilt in order to plead guilty? Why can't you just say, you know, I'm innocent, but jury will never believe me, so I want to get my acceptance of responsibility discount, and therefore I'm pleading guilty? That's fine, isn't it? There's nothing wrong with that.
I mean, with respect to the voluntariness issue, Your Honor, there was no reference
That's
to...
That's voluntary. It would be voluntary.
Mr. Walker maintains that it was not voluntary.
No, I understand he maintains it, but the fact that if you thought that you couldn't get a free trial, if you thought that you couldn't get a fair trial, wouldn't that be a compelling reason to plead guilty? It'd be entirely voluntary.
Well,
wouldn't it?
Yeah, he was right? Distressed. He was not thinking rationally, cogently. This was not a product of a calm, rational contemplation on his part. He maintains that the conditions were such that he simply was not capable of making a sound, voluntary decision.
Well, the trial judge didn't buy that. He conducted an evidentiary hearing on the motion to withdraw the plea, didn't he?
That's correct.
At which your client was permitted to testify about this claim that he was under duress, and the judge rejected that as a factual matter.
The judge essentially responded by saying, "Mr. Walker, the only thing you've done is change your mind." and that's not a sufficient compelling reason to grant you leave to withdraw your plea. Anybody who's going to withdraw their plea, wants to withdraw their plea, is doing it having a change of mind.
Well, didn't he also say that we covered all this factual ground at the plea hearing?
Yes.
A change of plea hearing? In other words, we covered your claim that you can't get a fair trial and that you think there's been too much pretrial publicity, etc., and there's nothing new here as a factual matter. Isn't that also part of the judge's conclusion, rejecting the motion to withdraw the plea?
Your Honor, Mr. Walker continues to maintain this was not a voluntary plea, and he continues to maintain that this day.
Okay.
Well, what's the evidence that it's not voluntary?
Well, the evidence that it's not voluntary is primarily the exchange during the Rule 11 colloquy that I mentioned, that when the judge specifically asked him, is this a knowing and voluntary plea, he says, no, I'm pleading guilty because I can't get a fair trial. I mean, there is no requirement that under Rule 11 that he admit specifically this is a knowing and voluntary plea. Obviously, Rule 11 is for the judge to determine that it's a voluntary plea. But typically, they ask that specific question. And when they asked it here, his response was such that one should conclude, no, it's not a voluntary plea, Judge. I'm just pleading because I can't get a fair trial.
And so what should the judge have done? Refused to accept a guilty plea?
The judge should have inquired further.
He did.
And asked him to...
He did inquire further.
But he didn't elicit the...
Well, what's he supposed to do? Have a 15-minute interrogation or what?
I think what he should have done is gone further and asked the additional question... Mr. Walker,
like
is this a knowing involuntary plea?
But that's just asking a person legalese. Knowing involuntary, it's not...
Mr. Walker maintains that that's the only thing that could have been done here that would make a record sufficient for the judge later to conclude that it was a voluntary plea. Your Honor, with respect to the issue of the notice under Burns versus United States, and particularly the notice as required under Rule 32H, we maintain that the failure of the judge to give defense any indication prior to pronouncement of the sentence that he was going to impose a sentence outside the advisory guideline range violates Rule 32H.
Rule 32H speaks in terms of notice of a potential departure, and that's not what we have here.
Well, Your Honor, Judge McKinney did not couch his reasoning and the basis that he used in terms of a departure. But if you look at what he did say, it was a clear reflection of an intention to impose a sentence within the guideline range. However, the guidelines in this particular case didn't take into account certain things. Specifically, he said it didn't take into account the number of victims. Of course, I didn't give any response to this because I had no idea this was going to be a basis for this upward sentence.
How could you not know? I mean, it was a matter of record how many victims there were, right? And you had to assume that the judge was going to consider the fact that there were four victims in fashioning an appropriate sentence.
We can't dispute the fact. However, the guidelines do, in fact, account for the number of victims.
That doesn't matter anymore. Post-Booker.
Well,
that's irrelevant.
You know, and that appears to be what the Eighth Circuit has said now with the case that Mr. Warden provided a supplemental authority. And that case, basically holding that 32H is no longer applicable, that due process is satisfied by virtue of the fact that a person becomes aware of what the statutory maximum is, I think contravenes the underlying purpose of 32H. That is...
Now, wait a second. Go back before the guidelines. When you went in for a sentencing, all you knew were the statutory minimum and maximum. You're envisioning a kind of two-stage hearing. In the first stage, the judge, even though there hasn't been a sentencing hearing, the judge somehow Besides, he's going to he's likely to exceed the guidelines, and he tells the defendant, and then you have the sentencing hearing. That's pretty awkward, isn't it?
Well,
pre-sentencing? So he sentences before he has the hearing? What sense does that make?
Your Honor, I think due process here requires more than
due process. As Judge Sykes pointed out, after Booker, you know that the judge has to consider the statutory factors as well as the guidelines. And so you prepare your sentencing pitch with that in mind. You look at the sentencing guidelines, character of the defendant, need for deterrence, and so on, and so forth. And you ask yourself, what are the facts that might influence the judge to go above or below the guideline range? That's what you have to do.
Your Honor, I'd submit that that view undermines the defendant's right
to present
argument.
Look, you have the statutory factors. You know what they are. You know what the guidelines are. You have to be prepared for the judge to take account of all the facts that are relevant to those statutory factors and to the guidelines. That's how you have to prepare.
Your Honor, I submit that there's no way to anticipate.
Well, you'll just have to, because otherwise there are going to be two sentencing hearings, right? The first, when the judge all by himself decides that he might like to go above the guidelines, and then the second sentencing hearing, in which you target those particular warnings that you've gotten from him.
Your Honor, I don't think
that's not going to be this. I mean, forget it.
I don't think it's too much to ask.
That's ridiculous. No, it is too much to ask. Because it asks the judge, in effect, to do the sentence before the sentencing hearing, to decide tentatively before the sentencing hearing what the sentence is going to be.
Your Honor, the pronouncement by the judge of factors that he's taking into particular consideration immediately prior to imposing sentence is something that the defendant ought to be able to have an opportunity to address. Many times, defense counsel could be taken off.
But you understand the problem. You're asking the judge to do a kind of pre-hearing sentence, tell the defendant's lawyer what sentence he's thinking of giving so that you can focus in on that sentence.
I'm only asking
in this context. That's what you're asking for. You want the judge, before the sentencing hearing, to warn you that he's thinking that he might impose a higher sentence.
Just like Rule 32H requires now, Your Honor.
No.
That's all that I'm asking. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. McKinley. Mr. Warden?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is James Warden. I represent the government here today, as I did before the district court, beginning with the issue of the court's denial of the motion to withdraw the guilty plea. I think it's important to look, as the court referenced, to the rule itself and how that rule is to be applied. And in the language of Rule 11, in the section that deals with ensuring a guilty plea, it says in 11A2, that before accepting a plea of guilty, the court must address the defendant personally in open court and determine that the plea is voluntary and did not result from force, threats, or promises other than those in a plea agreement. And as the court well pointed out then, it's not these magic words that are said by the defendant, but it's the district court's determination after observing the defendant that this is done voluntarily, and the record supports that in this case. Beyond the factors that were already brought up before the court today, let me emphasize a couple of matters that are essentially in the brief, but critical to this process is acknowledging that the parties were and the court was surprised by Mr. Walker's statement that he wanted to plead guilty after the motion was denied. There was a recess of approximately an hour during which Mr. Walker conferred with his counsel, the same counsel who's here today, and in that process reviewed the court-approved petition to enter a plea of guilty document with him, which was executed and then followed by the district court in the Rule 11 colloquy that followed the filing of that petition. That colloquy lasted for a full 40 minutes. in the petition. There's a specific paragraph in which the defendant at the time, Walker, said he's pleading guilty voluntarily. And then when there was some reason to believe that it might not be voluntary during the colloquy, the judge engaged him in a conversation about that and went beyond what defense counsel, appellant's counsel said here today. When the judge asks him, and I'm referring to starting on page 21 from the transcript of that hearing, when the judge asks him, are you pleading guilty of your own free will because you are guilty, he says, I'm pleading guilty because I'm not going to get a fair trial. Then the judge warns him, if that's what you think, then this is not a voluntary plea. A voluntary plea is that you're pleading guilty of your own free will because you are guilty. Then the defendant says, yeah, man, I'm pleading guilty. And that's where counsel stopped today. But the court goes on with another critical question. The court then says, in response to the statement, I'm pleading guilty, the court says, because you are guilty. And Walker says, because I am guilty. And so the court, with those facts, with the Rule 11 compliance, with the petition, with the time to consult with counsel, had a clear record that this plea was voluntary and so did not abuse his discretion when it denied the motion to withdraw the plea. I think the government's position is clear in the brief and based upon the colloquy with counsel this morning. I don't believe I need to add much with respect to the argument about the notice. This is a new era post-Booker. This was not a guidelines departure situation. Judge McKinney did a very careful job of following the guidance that the courts, including this court, have laid down with respect to the process he followed. It was uncontroverted what the sentencing guideline advisory range was in this case. He did that first as he's supposed to. There was no dispute about that. Following that, the judge referred carefully to the provisions of Section 3553. He mentioned those provisions in the record and which ones he was considering. And then he explained in detail, much of this is cited in my brief, but he mentioned in detail why he thought the advisory guideline sentence was not the appropriate sentence in this case. And then he explained that and gave the other sentence. Some courts have discussed the reasonableness as a factor in this. That really goes, I mean, the basis, sort of the amount of the variance, that really goes more to the reasonableness issue here. And that wasn't argued during the argument this morning, but I'll just emphasize that the range here maxed at 210 months. The sentence the judge gave is only 5 months more than one guideline range above that.
Do you think Rule 32H has any continuing operation post-Booker?
That's the question I was afraid the court would ask, Your Honor. Let me try to answer it this way. Let me start by saying not under the facts here, because this clearly was not a departure situation. It's conceivable to the government that a district judge, and I would say carefully, I would hope district judges wouldn't do this because they'll probably regret the day they do, but a district judge may announce a sentence in the pre-Booker language of a departure and use that kind of language. I suppose in that situation you'd have an argument. If the judge says, I'm departing from the guidelines and doesn't reference 3553 but only references the guidelines, but maybe that's going to really be the argument that that's a reasonableness issue. I look at the Eggenberger case, which I cited, the Eighth Circuit case, and what this really comes down to is due process notice. And Judge Posner very clearly pointed out what that issue is there. But what's critical here, and again this is partly in the points Judge Posner made, no one knows more than the defendant and obviously his counsel with respect to the discovery process, such as in this case, what the aggravating factors are. The tape that was played, as the court knows from the record, this assault was recorded at tapes at the penitentiary.
But that was true pre-Booker, too.
Well, my point, Your Honor, is that that the test now, maybe this doesn't answer your question as well as you wanted, the test now is there due process notice? And I think as long as there's due process notice, we don't have to honor 32H if the process is followed the way it was here, which is what this court and other courts have said to do.
Well, it's my understanding that the Sentencing Commission is encouraging district court judges to continue to apply departure analysis before they get to 3553, which I assume you know about. And that presumably at least some district court judges are doing that, and presumably some of them are invoking departures, if we still use that language, as they would have been before Booker, when they calculate the guidelines sentence or the guidelines range as an initial matter before getting to 3553 and deciding whether to impose an out-of-guidelines sentence.
And my response to that, Your Honor, is that that may speak more to the issue of the reasonableness of the sentence. In other words, if the sentence, as this court said, if it's within the advisory range, it's per se reasonable. If it's outside the range, you have to look at other factors.
Right, but the rule imposes a procedural hurdle.
Right.
Reasonableness is our appellate standard of review, which,
right.
You know, I agree with you on that. Obviously, that's how it would ultimately be evaluated on review. But if there's still an existing and viable procedural requirement of prior notice,
the
in the rule based on Burns case, what do we do with that?
The government's position, Your Honor, is that 32H essentially is gone.
Okay.
Certainly when the process is as done here. I'll limit my answer
okay.
to that.
That's fair.
Under 32H, which requires reasonable notice for the departure, how much notice was typically given? Would it be at the same hearing, or would it be before the hearing? Or
in my experience, Your Honor, in our court, in the same court where Mr. McKinley practices, it would be a few days before.
Before the sentencing hearing itself?
Yes, Your Honor. But a matter of maybe only a few days after the disclosure process with the pre-sentence investigation report has been completed and the parties have had a chance to file responses to that. The other thing, let me just say quickly, is two important things here with respect to that issue in this specific case. Number one, Judge McKinney had told, in terms of the notice, Judge McKinney had told Walker that his maximum sentence was 80 years because he pled guilty to four of those counts, and that's clear in the record. He didn't say 20 years. He said 80 years. The other thing is there was no plea agreement in this case, and so there was sort of no basis to presume this would be a guideline sentence. In the Rule 11 colloquy, the court told Walker that these are advisory. They're not binding on the court anymore. And so he had notice in those ways that the sentence may be an out-of-guideline sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, let me just ask.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's fine. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ward.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McKinley?
The court has a question.
Okay, I have a question. After Judge McKinney sentenced, at the end of the sentencing, he said to both counsel, anything else? Wasn't that your cue to say, Judge, you know, I was surprised by the weight you gave to the number of victims, and I'd like an opportunity to...
It was, Your Honor. If you're going to, and you're asking why I didn't,
right.
Sometimes, Your Honor, I'm not as good a lawyer as I wish I was. I should have. I did not, and I should have raised that because looking back at the transcript and the basis that the judge cited for increasing the sentence here, I think there were considerable arguments that were appropriate to make, that should have been made, and that I think a defense lawyer needs to make in order to assure that the sentencing process is fair and accurate.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. McKinley and Mr. Ward, and we thank the defenders for undertaking this representation. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.